This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, a major fundraising effort underway to increase access to art. But we are going to start today with the fact that tomorrow is Pearl Harbor Day. Most Americans are aware of what happened at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. That tragic act killed more than 2,400 soldiers and wounded an additional 1,200. And it brought the United States into World War II. Just 10 weeks later, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed an executive order incarcerating people of Japanese descent under suspicion as enemies, confining them to several internment camps across the country for national security reasons. But many argue that it is also a manifestation of racism. One of those prison camps was right here in North Dakota. Special contributor Alicia Haglund-Thorpe tells us about a memorial to acknowledge what happened at that site and how it is bringing together Japanese American and indigenous communities.
Over 125,000 Japanese American men, women, and children were subjected to years of unjust confinement in prison camps across the United States during World War II. President Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066 moved this targeted group through 15 assembly centers and into 10 confinement sites, also known as concentration camps or imprisonment camps. One of the camps was a military post at Bismarck, North Dakota, known as Fort Lincoln, the Department of Justice internment camp governed by the Geneva Convention. Recently, a groundbreaking ceremony was held there to build a memorial for what is known as the Snow Country Prison Japanese American Internment Memorial. The goal is to bring healing to the troubling wartime treatment of Japanese and Japanese American civilians. Today, the former Fort Lincoln internment camp is the current campus of United Tribes Technical College. College administrators and staff have joined with Japanese Americans, including descendants of former internees, to create a memorial on campus to recognize and honor more than 1,700 first and second generation Japanese American citizens who were incarcerated here. Dennis Newman, former director of the Office of Public Information at United Tribes Technical College, has been involved with the project for several years. He says part of this project is to also fulfill a promise.
This was an important step in moving forward on keeping a promise that the college had made to internee survivors and the families of internee survivors who were incarcerated at Fort Lincoln on this site during World War II. There were promises made at a couple of what you would call gatherings. Some have called them pilgrimages. There were programs that were held at the college campus in 2003, one that was called Snow Country Prison. It was the grand opening of a traveling exhibit by that name, and the other in 2010. And at both of those events, there were internee survivors and families of internees. Then the president of the college, David M. Gipp, made promises to people that United Tribes would, as good stewards of this property, would create a memorial for the internees. And so this step is a big step forward to be able to break ground or have a ground blessing to have what is going to be in a courtyard area near one of the large former barracks buildings, a memorial that will mark the presence here of some 1,700 or so Japanese citizens and Japanese Americans who came through this internment camp during World War II.
Fort Lincoln was a surplus military post, originally constructed during the first decade of the 20th century. Many of the original buildings from 1903 are still intact. In 1941, the fort was converted into a U.S. Department of Justice detention facility for the confinement of non-combatant men. First imprisoned behind the 10-foot-high fences with guard towers were German-American and Italian-American merchant seamen. Then, in 1942, the first wave of Japanese-American citizens and immigrants from the West Coast were forcibly separated from their families and removed to the isolation and cold of Fort Lincoln in North Dakota. In 1945, more arrived from the Tule Lake Segregation Center in Northern California. They were sent here because they renounced their U.S. citizenship, therefore were considered enemy aliens. Barbara Takai has been researching Japanese internment camps around the country. Her family was incarcerated at Tule Lake. She says many falsehoods led to Japanese Americans renouncing their citizenship.
One of the things about the use of Tule Lake as a segregation center is that it brought all of the people who protested the wartime incarceration, it brought them to Tule Lake, and then the government began to pressure people and become extremely repressive toward the people who were at Tule Lake. And ultimately, with a denationalization program, to get rid of the people who protested. And the way they did that was to encourage people to renounce their citizenship as a way to remain in Tule Lake because the war was ending and there was a lot of angst about what would happen if you were forced out into a community without jobs, without housing, without a place to live. So 5,400 people in Tule Lake renounced their U.S. citizenship. Many did it to remain at Tule Lake until circumstances improved. Others renounced their citizenship in order to protest the injustice of America's abuse. And still others thought they believed they had to renounce their citizenship in order to go to Japan, that they would only be accepted in Japan if they had renounced their U.S. citizenship. So there were a lot of false narratives. There were a lot of myths. Nobody really knew what was happening. So there was a lot of confusion and ambiguity about what people's choices were and what the consequences were. And then the government began singling out young men to be removed because to Department of Justice camps as enemy aliens. They gave up their U.S. citizenship. Without their U.S. citizenship, they were deemed foreigners, enemy aliens. They had no rights. They were not protected. They were sent to Department of Justice camps. There were two. One was in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The other was in Bismarck, North Dakota.
Fort Lincoln got its name Snow Country Prison from an internee named Itaru Ina, who wrote of his time in isolation. His most famous haiku was written in 1945, where it says, quote, "The war has ended, but I'm still in the Snow Country Prison," end quote. Itaru's daughter, Satsuki, was born in the Tule Lake Segregation Center. She also wrote about her experience as a survivor and descendant of a Fort Lincoln internment camp internee. She's a doctor of psychology specializing in intergenerational trauma. She directed the 1999 documentary Children of the Camps, based on the letters exchanged between her parents. Here, she tells of how her father came to the Fort Lincoln location while the rest of her family stayed in the Tule Lake segregation camp.
North Dakota, Fort Lincoln. Here was designated as an internment camp governed by the Geneva Convention. So treatment here was much better for my father. So from Topaz, where my parents answered a so-called loyalty question identified as dissidents, they answered no to the two questions that sent them to Tule Lake, which was the maximum security prison for so-called disloyals. And that's where I was born. And while I was there with my parents, they began to draft young men out of the prison camp to fight in Europe and in the Pacific Islands. And my father gave a speech protesting that. He was charged with sedition for interfering with the draft and eventually put in the jail in Tule Lake and then sent to Bismarck, North Dakota. So American citizens didn't go to DOJ camps, but my parents decided to renounce their American citizenship, feeling there was no hope for their children in America. So they renounced, and then my father was automatically designated enemy alien, which made it possible for them to then send him to a DOJ internment camp. there was so much stigma attached to people who were sent to the internment camps. They were by their own community, other Japanese Americans, and the military officials saw them as not only disloyal but dangerous to the U.S. After we were all released from the prison camps, there was a lot of stigma associated with being a protester. So the story about the internment incarceration, like for my father, was suppressed and in many cases secret from even members of their own family. My father never spoke about his internment experience, but after he passed away and my mother passed away, I found the letters that they wrote to each other, 182 letters that they exchanged while my father was here, while my mother, brother, and I were still at the Tule Lake prison camp. And so I had like an opportunity to have his haiku poetry translated and to have the letters translated so that I could get firsthand references to their experience here. Since my family story was even more secret, I felt like I had to, after discovering these letters and diaries, learn more. And I was in the middle of making a documentary film about my parents' experience based on those letters. Came to Bismarck, the site here, the internment camp here.
The Snow Country Prison Japanese American Internment Memorial at United Tribes Technical College is an opportunity to highlight a story about resistance to oppression and raise up the memory of those who suffered incarceration just for standing up as citizens. This is very similar to the persistence of tribal people who have also been challenged throughout history. Dr. Denise Lajemodair, North Dakota's poet laureate and citizen of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, spoke at the memorial groundbreaking event.
The reservations are just similar to an internment camp. We've called reservations internment camps and concentration camps before, and we were put there, and the Japanese also were rounded up and put into internment camps. There's a commonality there.
Satsuki also shares her thoughts.
This is the ground blessing, and work will begin and hopefully complete in the next year or two. So it will be a destination point for my community to come here to have ceremony to remember, to honor the internees that were held here. It will be a point of education for the students on this campus. And for me, our healing from the massive repetitive racism and trauma inflicted on people of color, our relationship between the Native people and the Japanese American people is a model for working together in solidarity. And to me, personally, over time, I've come to believe that that is the only way that we are really going to heal our country from the ongoing and historic racism trauma that has, you know, been a part of the lives of people of color. And I think efforts have been made to keep us split and separated. But if we start working together, supporting each other, sharing, like there's going to be a drumming circle in the center of our monument. You know, Native drummers can be there for their ceremonies, and Japanese Americans can bring their taiko drums, their Japanese drums. We can have both drums at the same time. We can blend our ceremonies to honor the college history, the Native stories, and the Japanese American stories. So I'm really excited about what this can mean.
Former internees of Fort Lincoln internment camps and their relatives have visited the site for the last 40 years to reflect on the history of what happened. With the college's support, Japanese and Japanese American visitors have been welcomed to tour the site, share their stories, and participate in ceremonies.
So what is extraordinary is the leadership of the United Tribes Technical College has led an effort to acknowledge a story of Japanese American descent, to preserve that story and to honor it in a way that our own community has not done. For reasons of their own internalized racism and self-hatred, for an act that was completely justified, but that was condemned by the government propaganda as disloyal.
This memorial will be the first of its kind to acknowledge solidarity between Indigenous and Japanese American communities. The design of this memorial is based on a process used in Japanese ceramics called kintsugi. It uses a lacquer mixed with powdered gold, silver, or platinum to mend broken pottery. It highlights the cracks and turns them into part of the object's history and story. In this case, kintsugi represents the bonding of cultures and communities. This place will also serve as a receptacle for the tsuru, or paper crane offerings, that bring healing and wholeness to this space over time. The walls will be made of the original slate roofing tiles, flamed from the former prison's roof. There will be amphitheater seating in the courtyard, and the Four Directions drum circle will serve as the ceremonial center, the heartbeat of the memorial. This will be a shared ceremonial space that honors Ganbat, or endurance and solidarity, that has been exemplified by Japanese American and Indigenous resilience. An architectural group called Mass Design Group has partnered with the Tribal College and members of the Japanese American community to create this unique monument. The design group's mission is to build and advocate for architecture that promotes justice and human dignity. Model of Architecture Serving Society, or MASS, is an internationally renowned design firm with representation across 20 countries. Joseph Kunkel is a principal designer for MASS and also a citizen of the Northern Cheyenne Nation. He directs the Sustainable Native Communities Design Lab. He says when the request came in looking for a design group, the story of solidarity and resilience of these two particular communities caught their attention.
When we read the RFP, when the request for a design team was asked to come together for the five tribes of North Dakota to acknowledge another population's injustice was incredibly powerful. And that, in turn, was like, we just need to show up and think about ways in which we can support both the tribal community and the Japanese American community to make this come into fruition. My colleague Jeffrey Mansfield, being a Japanese American descendant of those that were interred here, similar to being Native American, Indigenous, like, how can we come together as a design team to think more holistically about bringing a project to fruition? And here we are.
This memorial promises to recognize and catalyze a broader reconciliation process around intersectional patterns of racial oppression and violence, and can serve as a model for other former camps around the country whose planners may be searching for a way to bring healing through the use of acknowledgement and memorialization.
That was a special contributor, Alicia Haglund Thorpe. Work on the memorial is funded by the Japanese American Confinement Sites Grant Program through the National Park Service, United Tribes Technical College, and Mass Design Group. It's expected to be completed winter 2024. More Main Street after this.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. The question why is very empowering. It's about the divine, it's about the moral, it's about the pleasurable, it's about fear. Why is everything? I'm not very good with authority and I'm not very good with limits. And so I like a question that gives me the ability to do whatever I want, whenever I want. I was born and raised in Manhattan on the edge of a neighborhood that most people would know as Spanish Harlem. I ended up in North Dakota because they offered me a job. It's that simple. And we've had a very good life here so far. Dispel these myths. Philosophy is boring. I guess I would ask you to ask yourself, are you boring? Do you think you have nothing of interest to offer anybody? You are philosophy. Philosophy is you. Everything you ask, everything you think, everything you want, everything you strive for, this is what makes up philosophy. Philosophy itself is compelling enough and exciting enough that it is pretty much the oldest discipline. And philosophers had more influence on the world than almost anybody. Plato, Aristotle, we live in their world. And so if you want to make philosophy exciting, you have to be exciting. Philosophy majors can't get jobs or make any money. Philosophy is the highest paid major of all of the humanities, and the rate of return is actually the same over a lifetime as engineering. Listen to Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life every second Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Words can be used to include or exclude people from a certain group, and that is certainly not a new invention. We get a little old-timey slang in this week's Plains Folk essay with Dr. Tom Ezern, The Drylander's Lullaby.
Montana has a historical vocabulary all its own, devising its own labels for people and processes of frontier settlement. I've described before how the word pioneer had its own meaning in the Treasure State, referring not to a doughty homesteader, but rather to a miner or cattleman who came before and held homesteaders in contempt. Homesteaders might be labeled pilgrims, with the intimation they would come and go, would not be able to stick it out on the northern plains. Or, in a yet more disparaging usage, a struggling farmer might have to bear the label honyocker. A scholar writing an American Speech in 1958, discussing pejorative terms applied to farmers, observes, "Most common of these terms is honyocker, still a fighting word in the western Dakotas, although I can say with good certainty that the word emerged not in the Dakotas, but in Montana." And when? In the heyday of homesteading settlement in eastern Montana, I should think, which was the early years of the 20th century. Well, sure enough, I ran an engram online to discern when the term began to be used in publications, and it was in 1909. Honyocker, the etymological genesis of which I still cannot vouch for, had some literary currency from 1909 to about 1918, and then largely disappeared for a while. In keeping with these circumstances, I find this notice in the Miles City Weekly Star, 23rd of June, 1909. "The honyockers are coming in bunches, and there is hardly a road in this part of the country that hasn't been closed up with their wire fences." About the same time, a sheep raiser from South Dakota declared, "I think the woolies will be all right until the honyocker and the Dukober." Now, Dukobers were a group of communal farmers from Russia. "The honyocker crowds me off the range, and I think this state of affairs is not far distant." Somebody had to talk back on behalf of the honyockers, and their poetic champion, I discovered just last week, was Harrison E. Banks, a homesteader from Lovina, Montana. He wrote a ballad, "A Drylander's Lullaby," 39 stanzas, first published in the Lovina Independent, 14th of July, 1922. In August, it got statewide circulation with republication in the Montana Farmer Stockman. "We took up a homestead out on a plains where somebody told us it never rains, but we had faith that we'd earn our bread, for we had visions of wealth ahead." Well, you can guess how this came out. The Banks ballad recounts the trials of hail, grasshoppers, drought, 40 below temperatures, and poor prices. "Our stock was gone, we raised no wheat, and mighty little we had to eat. Our eggs and our butter we took to town, but the grocer said, the price is down." Well, not included in the ballad are Banks's financial misadventures, as recorded in local newspapers, delinquent taxes, court actions to force payment of debts. However, I am happy to note, according to the Land Patent Index of the Bureau of Land Management, Banks proved up on his quarter section, the northeast quarter of Township 8 North, Range 23 West of the Montana Meridian, in 1914. As he says in his ballad, "Your Uncle Samuel has lost his bet. We've stayed 5 years and we ain't starved yet." A successful representative of a disparaged class, Banks envisions the day his grandchildren will ride in a limousine and sing, "Here's to Granddad, doggone his hide, he stuck." They should have put that on his tombstone. He stuck.
Dr. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, we learn about a $2 million capital campaign for the Jamestown Fine Arts Association. First this.
Lots of listeners have complimented Ashley Thornburg's interviewing skills over the years, and so have plenty of her guests.
Hi, my name is Bonnie Sommerfeld. I'm from Fargo, North Dakota, originally Valley City, North Dakota. I love all things Main Street. I'm a total fan. And when I come in to be interviewed by Ashley, it's so wonderful. I'm asked questions that are poignant, and I learn things about myself by answering the questions that I did not even know I had or that existed. So I just always look forward to it, and I hope everybody else does too.
If you appreciate thoughtful questions and hosts that take the time to listen, then step up and support Main Street and all the things you enjoy on Prairie Public with a gift of financial support. Just go to prairiepublic.org and open the red link that says donate.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The Arts Center in Jamestown has launched a $2 million capital campaign to purchase and renovate the former Wonder Bar, and that's a building that's west of its current location in the community. The group's mission is to enrich the Jamestown area community through the arts. Mindy Schmitz is my guest today, and she's the executive director of the Arts Center in Jamestown. Mindy, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me.
Happy that you are here. Mindy, give us some history of the Jamestown Fine Arts Association. It's been around almost as long as I've been alive, I think.
Yeah, I think it started in 1964, and it was just a group of local artists that wanted to display regional and local art. And so they came up with a space eventually that was donated to them, and ever since then, it's created a life of its own.
Now, elaborate for me, if you would. What is being offered today? What do you guys have that's going on now?
We offer a whole lot of things. Our cornerstone program is our Arts After School program, and that's for 3rd through 6th grade kids. Every day after school, we offer them a professional art class, 2 to 3 week sessions. We offer artist-in-resident program, of which we house a professional artist that teaches all of the elementary students in Jamestown, in the public school and St. John's, and also reaches Medina. We have a gallery that has a professional exhibit that rotates every 3 to 6 weeks. We have an Art for Life program with Heritage Center and Ave Maria. We have ongoing adult and kid classes. We have our Perfectly Paired experience where we bring in the opening of the show. The artist talks about their artwork and how they've come to be an artist. We have a gallery, a gala every year, which is this year is in March, which is our main fundraiser for the year. We have Oktoberfest, and of course, every Thursday, July through August, we have our downtown arts market where we bring in professional performances, and we have artists and vendors, and we do community art projects, and that's just a great, great thing for folks in Jamestown in the summer and the area.
I'm relatively new to the area, Mindy. Give me an idea of the arts scene, and I put that in air quotes, if you will, in Jamestown. To me, I'm not sure that I considered Jamestown really having an art scene, but boy, am I wrong.
You are wrong, and I was wrong when I started, too. I came onto this job about 5 years ago, and I can't believe all of the artists that we have in our community, and we are offering classes, and folks come to us and say, you should offer this class. Well, do you know an artist that would teach it? And they do. And so we've got artists all over the place, and they want to show their works. As a matter of fact, right now we're in the middle of our art annual show, and that's in the gallery, and that's all local, regional artists that have entered. And it's anybody from Jamestown to Fargo to Bismarck to Lake Park to Minto to Park Rapids,
sure.
You know, anything. It's great.
You say you recruit an artist in residence. Who's interested in coming to Jamestown? Do you have trouble recruiting folks to do that?
We haven't had any trouble. We just recently brought in somebody who is a graduate in environmental sciences, actually, from the University of Jamestown. But her art is clay and ceramics. And so she's bringing pottery and clay into the schools. And so that's a great experience. But we haven't really had an issue with our artist in residence
sure.
program.
You know, my daughter was just commenting over the weekend. My wife found some of her old artwork and it was perfect to share on Halloween. But she made the comment that maybe art has changed in public schools a little bit over the last decade or two. Maybe it's not as, I guess, in depth, in detail as it used to be. Is that, do you find that's the case too in what's offered in Jamestown?
Well, I think that's why we have this great partnership with the Jamestown Public Schools. They contract with us, and we bring that professional artist that teaches those art classes in those elementary classes. That's from K through 6. And they actually teach professional art. And so that takes the burden off of the regular classroom teacher to teach an art project or an art session. And this professional artist does that art class for them.
Sure, sure. So with such a broad scope of activities that you offer, is there competition now in the space that you have to be able to accommodate everyone's need?
Actually, there is, and that's why we've undertaken the capital campaign to renovate the space next door, because our Arts After School program is full to the brim. Our current classroom can only hold 15, and that's max. And we have a waiting list for virtually every class.
Let's get into talking then about your expansion plans. Give people an idea, first, of where this is located in Jamestown, for those folks who aren't quite familiar, and how close the old Wonder Bar is to where you are today.
Okay, well, the Art Center is right downtown Jamestown. We say it's right across the street from Zimmerman's Furniture. And the Art Center actually shares a wall with the Wonder Bar, the former Wonder Bar. And so we actually even share some utilities with them. And so it was a perfect opportunity for us to take on this project. We had a couple farmers on the board, and they said, you know, if you're a farmer and the section next to you comes up for sale, you do everything you can to try and get it. And so that's what we did, and it had been closed since COVID in 2020. And ever since we made the announcement that we were going to do this, the community has just said, we can't wait. We want that space renovated. It's kind of an eyesore right now. This is going to be great for the community and not to mention great for the kids.
Sure, sure. $2 million seems like a lot of money. How are you doing?
We're doing great. We're over halfway there, and we haven't really even started any kind of construction yet. So I know that when we start construction, people are really going to get excited, and we're very confident that we're going to get the money.
Give our listeners an idea of what you'll be able to do when that program, that expansion project is complete that you can't do today?
Well, like I said before, we're going to be able to accommodate more of those third through sixth grade students, but we also want to expand into middle school and preschool. And so we want to use that space for expanding classrooms. Right now, there's only room for 15 in our existing, and mm-hmm. when we renovate the space, there'll be up to 60 classrooms or 60 kids to be able to be in those spaces.
But certainly you offer programs for adults as well. How will they be impacted?
There will be new space for the adult classes as well. That's going to be entirely classroom space. And also above the Wonder Bar, there's going to be a couple of apartments that we'll have for visiting regional artists. And on the main level, there will also be two studios for those visiting artists to use, or we will be able to rent those out to other artists in town.
Enjoying our conversation with Mindy Schmitz. She's the executive director. Is that the correct title?
It is.
Okay. Of the Jamestown Area Arts Center. What are the challenges that you face with arts in Jamestown, Mindy? If I were to ask you, you know, what are the hurdles that you have to go through to really have a good program? What comes to your mind?
Well, for me, it's always funding, and it's a competition in trying to raise those funds. And it's also trying to get the focus out of, quite frankly, sports. I mean, we know arts are just as important or maybe even more vitally important to the education and the growth of humans, and we need to make that case. And it's just trying to get a louder voice sometimes.
Tell me about the art park that's right across the street.
Right. Well, in 2018, we opened the art park. We renovated a space that was a burned-out building, and the Arts Center board thought, let's buy this space and make it a green space. So that's what it was for a while, a green space. And then it evolved into the Hanson Arts Park, of which it has a boulder pavilion and a prairie grass ballet. And that's where we have our downtown arts markets. And so there's a stage where we have performances. You can rent out the space. We have our Oktoberfest there. That we've had weddings there. We've had receptions there. It's a beautiful, beautiful space downtown. People go there for lunch. It's great.
Tell me about the Kirkpatrick Gallery at the Frontier Village in Jamestown, and what is your relationship with that?
The Kirkpatrick Gallery is run by volunteers from the Art Center, and they sell their local artisan wares there.
Okay. So tell me how you also support local artists who want to get better at their craft well, in Jamestown, if I'm a painter, you know, I've kind of dabbed at this, but I want to get better. If I work with ceramics, I've dabbed at this, but I want to get better. What do you do for folks like that?
We would pair them up with other artists that we know in town that do their craft. And, for instance, we have a ceramic studio, and we have some folks that are in the ceramic studio often that are doing volunteer work or just working on their projects, and they more than welcome other folks to come in, and they learn from each other.
For folks that are inspired to support the Art Center and your capital project, Mindy, what should they do?
Well, they can certainly go to our website, www.jamestownarts.com, and look for the Raising the Bar page, and that's where they can donate. Or they can stop by. We're at 115 2nd Street Southwest in Jamestown. Or they can call us at 701-251-2496.
And I imagine you have schedules on that website as well.
We do. We have all of our art classes that are coming up, our exhibits that are coming up. Everything you want to know is on the website.
Mindy, you were presented with the first Mary Smith Award for your support of human rights from the Stetson County Human Rights Coalition. Tell me about that award and what it meant to you.
Well, I was absolutely humbled and blown away. I thought Mary Smith was one of the most inspirational women I'd ever met. She worked on the behalf of all folks to make their lives better. And for me to receive that award, I was blown away. And I'm trying to strive every day to be half of the person that Mary was, because she was extremely inspirational.
What's your future with arts in Jamestown?
Well, we want to get this project under our belt and just continue to offer great programming and have the community recognize that this is a place that they can become enriched with the arts.
Mindy Schmitz is the executive director of the Art Center in Jamestown. The group has launched a $2 million capital campaign to purchase and renovate the former Wonder Bar building, and that's west of its current location in the community. Mindy, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you.
More Main Street is coming up. Stay with us.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg with Craig Blumenschein, and joining us from our Bismarck studio is Root Cellar Sue. It's time for Main Street Eats. Welcome, Sue.
Hi, Sue. Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And it is gift-giving season.
Oh, my gosh. Don't tell me. We're into December of 2023,
yeah,
and I can't wait for 2024. It's been one of those years. So if you're thinking that you wanted, if you really, really, really love me and you want to buy me something for Christmas.
That's why we're doing this segment. I just figured this out. Gifts for the Foodie is what it's titled. Now I know why we're here.
Absolutely.
Holy cow, Sue.
Dropping big hints.
Are you listening?
I think she's talking to us.
I'm going to start up at the top and work my way down to stocking stuffers, see? So there's something for everybody here. But I have been in the market for a new set of cookware. And there's something called hex-clad hybrid perfect pots and pans. They have a little diamond pattern on. You can't scratch them with your utensils and things. And I would just love to have tried to finagle a set of those for Christmas. So if you really love somebody that loves to cook, they are a pretty highly rated set of pots and pans. There's 12 pieces for a mere $629.
Mm.
But you never know. They might come down a little bit before Christmas. The other pans I was investigating, and I don't know if you've ever touched any of these ceramic nonstick pans, green pan.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, they're free of PFASs, which are whatever plastic and, you know, bad things for you. They're supposed to be really environmentally safe from these things, and they work on induction ranges. They're dishwasher safe. And, you know, you can get 11 pieces of those for like $300. And they come in such glorious colors that I thought, oh, those would be like really nice to have.
Dishwasher safe pots and pans does sound very intriguing.
Yes. And I think they're quite lightweight. The ceramic, you know, they've got all these new materials, you know. So If anybody's in the market, and you know, I'm going to say this right now. My husband's like, I don't know why you need new pots and pans. I said, because they do wear out. You do know if you burn something in a skillet or in a big pot on your stove, that burned spot will never recover. It will always burn. And of course, Cuisinart is a very familiar name for people, and they have a nice multi-clad pro set. They're so heavy. The big pot is so heavy, I almost can't dump things out of it. But those you can get right now for like half price at $220. So if you really love the foodie in your family, that's the first thing I would look at is a new set of cookware. Because, you know, if yours are 10 or 15 years old, why not, right?
Do you need to take anything into consideration with these pots and pans, considering how popular things like induction stovetops are getting?
Well, you would have to definitely check to see if they worked on an induction range. I think that it all depends on how many layers are on the bottom of the pan. There's something there in the ceramic pans. I don't know if those work on induction ovens. Okay. But first of all, you have to know whether you have an induction range or not.
Well,
So I'm thinking, I don't think mine is an induction range, but I'm in the market for a new one of those too.
Oh boy.
I just can't find the one I want.
I think, and then your pots and pans.
And then of course the next best thing to have in a new set of cookware on a new range would be to have a slow cooker. Like I have I can't remember the brand, but I've had it for years and years and years. And it was the best investment I ever made. But I'm lusting after this Elite 6-quart slow cooker, which is a green pan variety or a green pan brand. It's a stainless steel slow cooker, but it's not like a crock pot. It has all these settings on it, and it has a removable liner. And so what you can do is you can actually brown your roasts in there and then turn it on to slow cook. You can simmer soups in there. They're so easy to clean. They have all these functions on them. And right around Thanksgiving, they were around the $250 range, and now they're up to $350. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to wait a little bit because I really don't need a different 6-quart slow cooker. But they're so pretty, and they come in so many stinking cool colors. I mean, what's wrong with having a colorful kitchen, right, if you're in it all the time?
If it brings you joy.
That's right. So now those would be like, you know, extravagant, I guess, sort of gifts for people. And I still can't convince my kids that it's their turn to become extravagant in my direction instead of the other way around. But maybe later.
So just out of curiosity, best Christmas gift related to food you've ever received?
Let me see here now. What could I say that was? You'd laugh at me if I'd tell you it was a Cuisinart 9-cup food processor.
I would never laugh at that.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
That is incredible. I use my food processor on like a daily basis.
I love it, and it's 720 watts, so it's so powerful.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. And it's got a big bowl, and you can use it for just about, you know, anything that you want to chop up. You can make pie crust in it. You can make coleslaw real easily. It's right. Yeah. I'm glad you like yours. I really love my yes, food processor. And everybody should have one of those, as well as a zester. We talked about that earlier.
Yes.
And that would make a great stocking stuffer. But when I was in Cancun.
Oh, you want to keep suggesting $300 gifts for
people?
No,
Okay, we're done with the $300 ones.
Okay.
I found something really interesting. I'll get to that. These all could be kind of stocking stuffers, but I found this something called 2 Tumbleweeds Foodie Dice that I thought, if you're a creative cook, you get a set of dice that has like 5 primary dice that have protein, cooking method, grains, herbs, seasonal vegetables, and you kind of like throw these dice all together and end up with a combination that you have to be creative and cook that night.
Like, roll your dice for dinner.
Yes!
Honey, I kind of like that.
I think it'd be great.
Can I take my Sharpie and modify the dice to
There's a vegetarian option, Craig. The only problem would be if you're like me and you live 30 miles out of town, you're probably going to have to, I don't live 30, 15 miles from a nice grocery store. You're going to have to be prepared.
What a fun idea, though.
I think so, too. I think it would just be so much fun to challenge yourself like that. And, you know, when you cook, the longer you cook, the better you get with combinations. You know what works and what doesn't work. So
I'll throw a gift idea in there because I'm told Santa's bringing one to our house.
Ooh.
So it's a new knife set. We've never really had one. This will be the first one. Don't tell my wife. That's what Santa's bringing.
You don't think she's listening?
I hope not.
I'm pretty sure my husband has never heard my show. So I think it's a thing.
So I agree with you. And even if you do not buy an entire new set of knives, I found an extra super long butcher knife just for cutting squash. You can buy them one at a time if you feel like you want to like build a setup over time. But you're definitely on the right track there.
They are a game changer.
Yes. Yeah. Good set of cutlery. And a scissors, a kitchen shears. Oh, my gosh. I use shears all the time in the kitchen. Good way to go.
I rarely hit it right, but I think I've got it right this time.
I think you do, too. That's totally awesome. So then you need recipes, right? So there's something from Uncommon Goods, which has a lot of cool stuff. It's kind of a family cookbook thing that has blank pages, conversion tables, a place for photographs, a space for memories. And you can fill in all the pages yourself, or there's a three-ring binder edition that you can pass those pages out, and everybody in the family that wishes to share can fill those pages in. So you could create – think of what a wonderful wedding gift
idea.
That would be for someone also. But, yes, that way you can get – and you can glue the recipe cards in there if you're willing to give your recipe cards away, which I hoard those things.
Right. Like,
one of these days, I'm going to organize them and get them in that book I keep saying I'm going to write. But,
that. And then real quick here, you've got on your list also a mushroom growing kit.
Yeah, wouldn't that be fun to grow your own mushrooms? You got six months to a year, though, because it does take some time. But they actually inoculate a log for you from this place. It's actually, you can get that at Uncommon Goods, too. So for $30, they'll send you a log that has been inoculated with shiitake mushrooms. And so you soak it and put it someplace cool and damp, and you can harvest your mushrooms when they show up. And mushrooms are good cooking.
Now thing. I know what I'm getting my husband for Christmas.
All right.
I see how that works.
We check in with Sue Balcom once a week. Thank you, Sue.
Thanks, guys. My pleasure.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 6th. On April 4th, 1917, the United States Senate voted to declare war against Germany. 2 days later, the House of Representatives endorsed the declaration, and the United States entered World War I. Just as they had done only 20 years before in the Spanish-American War, North Dakotans stepped up and enlisted for military service. Spanish-American War veterans like Frank Anders and John Kinney set aside their careers and chose to re-enlist. The veterans and new recruits found themselves off to foreign lands. Their first stop came late in the year, Camp Mills on Long Island, far from home as the holiday season approached. Their families back in North Dakota were naturally concerned. As they sent cards and packages, there was a great sadness about the boys so far from family and friends. And worse yet, they were right on the doorstep of New York City, described by one North Dakota newspaper as the most lonesome burg in the world for the boy who's broke or friendless. On this date in 1917, North Dakotans learned, much to their surprise, that the Big Apple did, indeed, have a heart. The Weekly Times Herald of Valley City reported that little old New York, from Hempstead to Brooklyn and the Bronx to Oyster Bay, pulled out all the stops to make sure that Uncle Sam's boys did not miss out on a thing for Thanksgiving. The newspaper reported that every home, from the most luxurious to the lowly, opened their doors for the young soldiers. Some of the hosts paid for transportation from the camp to their homes. Others picked up their guests in their personal cars. The newspaper observed to be seated once more at a holiday feast with all its bravery of table setting and good cheer, came as a wonderful boon to each boy. The soldiers felt a great deal of nostalgia as they thought of the vacant chair sitting by the dining table back in North Dakota. They felt uncertainty about how soon they'd be shipping out, knowing that they'd face a cold winter in the fields of France. However, the folks back home could take comfort in knowing that their boys had been able to partake of all the good food and good cheer of Thanksgiving. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Earl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show. Ever get a little bit confused about the latest technology? The latest copy of Dakota Digital Review aims to make that easier by talking about tech in a language we can all understand. We visit with Patrick McCluskey, the editor of the Dakota Digital Review. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.